Ein Talk von Jonathan Worthington in Englisch hören. The next talk will be in English. Jonathan Worthington will tell us some things about Crow we may not yet know. I'm very excited to hear some of the mysteries he wants to reveal.
Good afternoon, folks. My name is Jonathan Worthington, and today I hope to be sharing with you some things that you maybe don't know about Crow. Now, the first things you might not know are what is Crow and who am I? So let's take those first. Crow is a set of libraries for building distributed systems using the Raku programming language. Raku has various asynchronous programming features built into it, and one of those is the idea of supplies, which are a means of dealing with a stream of asynchronous values. And Crow builds on top of this to construct a system where we have pipelines of components that process messages and send messages over the network. So the most popular thing people use Crow for is building web services and web applications. I think it's fair to say that those are by far the most common types of distributed system that all of us are building these days. And a typical pipeline for that would look like this. We would start with a TCP or perhaps a TLS listener. After that, we have something that passes a HTTP request out of the packets that come from the network, from that listener, and it emits those. Then we might have some kind of middleware that is dealing in sessions or authorization. After that, the application comes, then we might, after it, have some kind of logging middleware, and then we have something that serializes the HTTP response into the packets, which then go out over the network. And this is asynchronous all the way through. Crow is very popular for building web services and web applications in Raku, and really most of the time you don't think that much about the asynchronous pipeline concept. But one of the nice things is that it basically means everything is middleware. If you, for some reason, hate the Crow request parser, you could actually put your own one in there, and provided it produced the Crow HTTP request type that is expected, then it'll all work out. In fact, we use this internally because we need to produce the same request and response objects, but we want to deal with both HTTP 1 and HTTP 2. So who am I? I work on the Raku runtime and compilers, and I also lead a company based in Prague called Edument, and this is actually a bigger company. I just run the Prague bit of it. We do a few things that are Raku related. I'm product manager for the Comma IDE, which various folks use to write their Raku code. I actually created Crow in the first place and designed this. And I do quite a bit of consulting work these days, a lot on developer tooling, because it turns out that there's quite a big market for that, and people who have compiler and runtime skills are quite useful for this kind of work. And I also do a bunch of Raku consulting as well, helping out companies that are getting Raku systems into production or running them in production and need some help or some development support and so on. So let's start out by taking a look at something that is not quite so commonly used or known about. Crow isn't just for HTTP server-side stuff. It actually includes a HTTP client too. And one of the really nice things about this is that if you have learned how to use Crow on the server side, you will be quite familiar with the request and the response objects because they're the very same classes on both sides. It offers an asynchronous API, and let's take a look at a few little examples. So here is how we can make a simple request. We use the Crow HTTP client module. We then do a GET request. We specify the URL that we want to get. And that gives us back a promise, which will be kept when the response arrives. And it'll be kept as soon as we've actually passed the response headers. It doesn't wait for the body to arrive and so on. So we can get the response. We can maybe dump the headers if we're curious about them. And then we'll get the response body. Here we'll just get all of it at once and we'll await it. And this is just going to be a string of HTML that we have here. and we can just print out how long that is. So that's the basic pattern of doing these requests. If we make a request to something that does JSON, then what we get back when we await the response body is already passed for us. So this has been passed into a JSON array, which is pretty convenient. The way it does this is that the HTTP client in Crow is configured with body parsers and body serializers. Again, they are the very same ones that are used on the client side as well, which is also a pretty nice bit of reuse. So it looks at the content type header, it sees its application JSON, or probably in this case, it's actually some other media type with the plus JSON bit at the end, which tells us that the format is JSON. So we pass that. And this particular request fetches all of the repositories that a particular user has. This is a public API endpoint, which is pretty easy to query. And then what I want to do is figure out which are the most popular languages used across these different repositories. So I do a map of the repositories. I extract the language key in the hashes that are part of this array of repository information. And then I turn it into a bag. And a bag is a data structure that basically you can think of it like a hash, where the keys are the objects and the values are how many of them we have. So here I can immediately see that there's 7 repositories where there's C code and 2 repositories where there's HTML code. If you're dealing with something that Crow doesn't have a body parser for, you can plug those in very easily as well to the client and also to the server side if you're dealing with something there as well. Since it's asynchronous, we can also deal with streaming bodies. So here I'm going to make a request for a sort of large file. It's not that large, but I don't want you all copying this code and then giving me a huge bill for my server. So then we will receive the body asynchronously. And I've just grabbed the content length here. Please don't steal this code too literally, because it's possible the server could send the thing with a chunked encoding and there isn't a content length. And then we're going to use a construct called React. And React is a way to run a small event loop, if you like, for a while. That's not quite how it works under the hood, but it's a nice mental model. And we say, I want to React whenever there is some data coming from the byte stream of the response body. And we get those as binary data. We get them just in blob objects in Raku. And then I'll count up how many bytes we have received so far using a state variable. And underneath, I'll just say, well, we have got this many bytes. We'll do a little calculation of the percentage that we have so far. And in reality, we would probably write this out to a file, for example, or send it off somewhere else over the network. So far, I've just been taking the Crow HTTP client object, not making an instance of it, and just making calls on it. When you do this, it just makes a connection. It does the request, it gets the response, it closes the connection, and that's it. One thing we can also do is make an instance of the client. This has a couple of uses. The first one is that it lets us have persistent connections. A second one is that it also lets us specify some properties that will apply to all of the different requests we make with the client. And this is very convenient if we're going to be querying some kind of API, for example, and doing a lot of requests. It's safe to use this from as many threads as you want. So you can create one client instance and you can use it from lots of different concurrent threads. It won't get confused. It's designed for this internally. So here we make a instance of it. We configure it with a base URI, which is the GitHub API service. And then I will just use basic authentication to pass in my username, and I've created a personal access token or whatever they are called, and have not shown you what it is. So then I'll make a request that uses the defaults that I set up above. So I don't have to put the full URL here. I just write slash gists and it'll be concatenated. In fact, concatenated is a little bit of an understatement. It will use the URI concatenation algorithm, not just a string one. So if you actually put a full absolute URI here, it'll go and actually get that. It won't just do some silly bit of string concatenation here. So that's kind of nice. We then specify a content type. We specify a body. And because the content type says it's a JSON type, that's how Crow knows that it should serialize this body into JSON. So we then get back the response, which is just the object. It doesn't have the body yet. We await the body, and then we index it to grab out the HTML URL of the GIST that was created. And this is how we can programmatically create a GIST using the GitHub API, using the Heroku language. And that's a fairly pleasingly small amount of code there. And it does much more. You can configure redirect following. It's got some sensible defaults there, so it won't go and follow infinitely or something like that. You can plug in different body parsers and serializers. We include JSON and the web form and the multipart web form used for uploads as standard. It does persistent connections. It does HTTP1 and HTTP2. There's also proxy support. There's a cookie jar, and there's a bunch of smaller things that I haven't talked about here. So in general, it's a fairly reasonable choice if you're doing things with Heroku. There's probably some which are simpler to use if you don't need all of the async bits especially. But as soon as you're into an asynchronous environment or want some of these features, then I think it's a pretty nice bet. It's the client I tend to reach for these days. So Crow also does WebSockets, and it does them both server side and client side. And following the theme, there's shared types across the server side and the client side, and shared components in terms of the message passing and serialization on each side as well. In fact, it's a little bit more symmetric with WebSockets than with HTTP, which is kind of nice. WebSockets map very nicely onto Heroku supplies. So when we have a WebSocket, we receive a stream of messages. And those messages are then given to us as message objects, and they're emitted on a supply. So we get them asynchronously and we can process them asynchronously. When we're working on the server side, this is very nicely integrated with the Crow HTTP router. So we can say, okay, I'm going to have this GET endpoint, and then I immediately want to upgrade it to a WebSocket connection. And you then provide a supply block. I'll show you an example in a moment to say how we're going to do the processing of the messages and to send messages off to the client as well. So to do this, I wrote a small application that I will walk you through, and it shows off both the WebSocket client and the WebSocket server. And I've called this poll share. And the idea is that we have some URLs and we want to poll them regularly, and we want to be told over a WebSocket whenever one of those URL changes, or rather the content in that URL changes. And we'll have many different clients that can connect to this web service API, and they might request the same URL or express interest in the same URL, and we only want to poll it once per time interval. We don't want to poll it repeatedly again and again for every single client who wants it. So we could have, say, 10 clients interested in a particular, say, RSS feed. We can be polling it, and then we can tell them all over the connection, like, oh, okay, there's a change there now, and we will only have had to poll it just the one time. So let's go and have a look at how this is done. So here I have my server side of the application running, and I'll start up some of the clients as well. So here I'm going to be polling the Guardian RSS feed for whatever news they have. And then here we'll poll two different RSS feeds, the Guardian and the BBC. And this one just wants the BBC. You'll notice that there are only two unique URLs to poll here, but we are we're subscribing across three different clients. But what we hope is that these will be deduplicated. And if we look at the server here, it starts listening. We can see these three request and response lines. We get a 101 response, which means we successfully upgraded this connection from HTTP to WebSocket. And then we're only checking these two URLs once each, which is exactly what we were hoping would happen. So let's take a look at the code while that runs. So here I am using the Crow WebSocket client module, and I'm making an instance of it. And I am passing this JSON argument here, which is a way of saying that the messages that I'm going to be sending back and forth over this WebSocket should be serialized and deserialized using JSON. And you can plug in whatever body passes and serializers you want to the WebSocket client. And this JSON option is covering a very common case, and it just saves you a bit of boilerplate. Then we're going to connect to the service, and we'll see the server side of this poll endpoint in a moment. Then we'll start a little event loop. And inside of this, we're going to be listening for notifications that come to us over the WebSocket, telling us that URLs that we're polling have changed. And when that happens, then we will just say, okay, there's new content at this URL. Just looking at this a little bit more closely, the messages are just like when we saw the HTTP client before. We have the messages, and the messages have a body, and the body can be received asynchronously. In fact, the WebSocket protocol also has ways of doing fragmented bodies, so we don't necessarily have it all at once. So here I get the body. It's been passed as JSON. I destructure it here into the URL. We also get the latest content, but I'm not really using that. I don't care about that at the moment. I just put out the URL that changed. Now, last is used also in for loops after we have processed the last value in an asynchronous context, and particularly in a WebSocket context, it means that the connection was closed. And that is the way that we can say, oh, we lost a connection, and we'll exit. So that's how we get the notifications, and then we take each URL that we're interested in, and we send a JSON message for each one to subscribe to changes to this URL. And that's what the service will be doing for us. If I press Control C, I want a nice orderly shutdown of things, so I'll just close the connection, and done gets us out of this event loop. And since done means no more messages will be processed, then we won't process the last message and print lost connection when we've intentionally closed the thing. So that's the client side. Let's look over on the server side. So here is my root block written using the little, if you like, Crow internal DSL for writing the HTTP routing specification. And we say when we get the GET request, then we want to match the signature here. And the signature just says I expect one URL segment, and it should be the literal string poll. And if I get that, then I want to upgrade the connection to a WebSocket. We pass colon JSON here to indicate that we're going to be speaking JSON over this WebSocket. And then I have a little subroutine called handle client. And we'll look at that in just a moment. Before I do that, however, let's talk just a bit about the way that a Crow Web application runs. When we get requests to be processed by a Crow Web application, they are processed using the RACU thread pool. And that means the application automatically scales up over multiple threads as much as you need for the amount of requests you're getting or so far as your system can handle. And that means that any code we write, we have to get used to the fact that it might be running on multiple threads. Now, in a lot of web applications, this doesn't really matter that much because very often we are doing relatively straightforward things. We're rendering templates, we're calling a database. Of course, there's concurrency going on, but the database tends to handle that. And if you're using something like DBPG, that provides a thread-safe pool of connections. So again, you don't have to worry about it so much. For my application, though, I am going to be keeping the set of subscriptions in memory, and that means that I need to worry about all of this threading. So I need some way of keeping track of how many things are subscribed to different URLs. That's going to be the URL count. Here, we'll track the previous content that was at that URL the last time we polled it, and then we'll have this supplier hash. And this is also keyed on the URL, and this is how we will provide notifications of change. And a supplier is the production end of an asynchronous stream. It's a way we can produce an asynchronous stream of values, if you like, publishing them. And then we can obtain from it a supply, and that is the receiving end. And the typical pattern is we keep the supplier end to ourselves, private, so only we can publish, and we share the subscribing end with the rest of the world. So the start method receives a URL. We then update the URL count. We just increment how many things are interested in polling this URL. And then here we create a new supplier if we don't already have one. That's the slash slash equals, the defined or equals bit. And then we return the supply, which is the subscribing bit. And many different WebSocket connections could have the one supplier and subscribe to it. So that's going to be how we'll broadcast the changes. And we'll look at how that happens in a bit. Here is stop. Stop does basically the opposite. It decrements the count. If it reaches zero, then we'll delete any previous content so we don't have a memory leak. We'll do the same with this supplier, which is now unused. So that is that. Now, there's a couple more methods. We'll come back to them a little bit later. Now, let's return to how this is all used from the WebSocket. So, when I get a WebSocket, I have a block here that is called for each WebSocket connection, and I get passed a supply. And this is a supply of incoming messages that I get sent on the WebSocket. And I also should produce a supply. And a supply is basically a supply block is a thing that can subscribe to other asynchronous sources of data, and it can emit its own values as well. And unlike with React, where React runs immediately and blocks until it's done, with supplies, we actually produce something that something else can subscribe to and then asynchronously receive the values from. I have an array of URLs that we're subscribing to, so I can unsubscribe them when this connection gets closed a bit later. And you see, I call stop for each of those. Whenever I get a request on the WebSocket, and this body subroutine is just a little utility subroutine here that just flattens out WebSocket messages into their bodies. I'll use destructuring again to pull out the URL. I'll add it to my subscriptions array, and then I'll start subscribing to this. Now remember, start returns a supply. That is going to emit the latest content of that URL whenever it changes. And here I will send that as a JSON message. It gets serialized for me over to the WebSocket client. So that's the WebSocket part, and that leaves the question of how do we do the polling? So that happens just up here. So shared polls is an instance of this poll set, and that means that all of these places we're using it, be it here, down here, and inside the code I'm about to show you, will get the concurrency control applied. Now, the reason that I don't go and do the polling inside of poll set is because it would entail holding this lock for quite a long time, and that's not really ideal. We want to keep this bit of state protected, but we don't want it blocking up all of the other parallelism and concurrency that might go on in our application. So here we are going to start a reactor. And this comp when I should have React like this, What it means is that I want to block the current thread until this React ends. When I say start React, it means I want to start a new worker on the thread pool, and I want it to react. Now, this does not necessarily mean a new thread. In fact, all of this is pretty efficiently done and non-blocking. So a lot of React blocks, you know, potentially thousands of React blocks, could actually be scheduled if they're only doing a little bit of work across just like one thread pool thread or something like that. This is doing a lot of nice things under the hood for us. And we can say every 15 seconds, which is maybe a bit aggressive in reality, but for a demo, it's fine. I want to poll the URLs. Now, before I do that, let's go back to the poll set and look at the two other methods that we have in here, which I'm going to be using. The first one is called URLs to check. And this just takes the keys of the URL count hash. And the reason we do eager there is because keys is lazy. We don't produce the full list of keys in memory and then go and iterate over it normally. But this time we want to. We actually want to eagerly take a snapshot of it. And the reason is that if we just return keys and it's lazy, and then we start changing the hash, then we might start getting some problems. So we do eager to force a copy of that. And then down here, we have a method handle new content. And this is the other side. So this is how we get the things we're going to poll and see if they have new content. Then when I get new content, I get the URL and the new content. I don't know if it's different yet. So I say, with any previous content, if I have some, so this is like if defined, I get the previous content, we compare it using not equals, and then we update the what we think was the previous content with what's new. We grab the supplier, and we then emit that this new content has changed. And this emit here will end up triggering this whenever here in all of the clients which are interested in this URL, and that's how we end up producing the result. So if we don't have any previous content, we just store the current new content as that. This is what happens on the very first time we poll it. I guess the alternative behavior would be to always consider this as new, as a change, but I've done it the other way around. So back here, we get the URLs to check. You can ignore this whole race thing for a moment. This is otherwise just a for loop. We get the URLs. We say, yeah, we'll check this URL. We then use the Crow HTTP client, as shown earlier today. We get the body text. You know, we don't want to accidentally trigger, say, JSON deserialization or something like that. So we'll just get it as text. And then we'll call handle new content. So notice that only this call, which eagerly gets all of the URLs to check, and this call are done under the concurrency control, and the HTTP request itself doesn't clog things up. Now, I've done one more little thing in here, which is that I've realized, well, actually, HTTP requests are really network bound, and there's no reason that we can't just make a few of them at a time. So I've used race for here, and that means that the loop will run concurrently. And the default configuration might not be very ideal for us. So I've said, I want to distribute this over workers by one at a time. And I want to have degree 8. That means up to 8 requests going on at a time. And this again, is a bit smarter than really spawning 8 different threads in the background or reusing 8 different threads, because actually, as soon as we've done the first part of the request, the rest is asynchronous. So we're really waiting for the network response for most of the time here. And that is all. And if we go back and take a look over in this here. We can see there was a little bit of new content at The Guardian, and the BBC today have been a little bit more active in updating their news. Maybe there's more happening in Britain than the rest of the world. Who knows? So there we are. In summary, a WebSocket client, a WebSocket server here, and then we've talked a little bit about how in a Crow application we need to think about the concurrency control, and had a little example of how we might do that as well. And another example of the HTTP client there. So let's go and look at a few other things. Something we quite commonly encounter when implementing web services is OpenAPI. And OpenAPI is a specification language for a HTTP API. It specifies the routes, that's the URLs that you will call, what HTTP methods to request those URLs with. It also has information about the body of the request and the response. This is really useful for many things. There's automatic documentation producers that work off this. There's various ways of calling these APIs, which is easier based upon that specification. And for our purposes, we can also avoid reproducing quite a lot of the information and requirements that are in that specification when we implement the API using Crow as well. So the key thing we want to do here is to not repeat lots of things that show up in that specification document. And there's quite a high risk of that if we just go and implement it directly using the Crow HTTP router. We'd have to repeat, for example, the various route URLs and the various things that are in those. We'd have to repeat the request methods. We'd have to do validation of the incoming body. And it's much better if we can just leave all of that to the specification, extract that, and then all we have to do afterwards is to add the implementation of the API. So here's an example of how part of an OpenAPI specification looks. This is just one endpoint or route, however you might want to call it. This is going to be at the URL slash clone dataset. It's a HTTP post. There's an operation ID here, and the idea of the ID is that we can refer to it when we implement the API, and that means we can get all of the various bits that are described in the specification applied automatically. Here we can see the request body, and there's a schema here which says how the body should look. We'll see that in a moment. And then we have the various response codes that can result from this request and what they mean for documentation purposes. So a 204 means that we successfully cloned the data set, and a 409 is an indication that normally that you gave a name to clone the data set under, which already exists in the database. So there's a conflict there. That's what 409 means. This example, by the way, is taken from an application called Agrimon, which is for calculating how much nitrogen will go into the air when cows fart and other similar farming activities that happen. And it's used in Switzerland, both for farms to figure out how they might improve their efficiency and at the regional level. This is the clone dataset schema. You can see that we're having an object sent along there in the JavaScript sense, requires three properties, and then there's a description of what they are below and their type. Not the most exciting one, but you get the idea. And this is all information that we would not want to have to repeat inside of our Crow implementation of this API. So as well as using the HTTP router, we also use this module OpenAPI routes from definition, which basically is the bit that maps the model into Crow routes and lets us just write the extra bits that we cannot get from the specification. This is built using a couple of other modules, OpenAPI model and OpenAPI schema validate, which are not tied to Crow, definitely not tied to the server side of things, and it'd be nice at some point to get a client-side module based on these as well. So how do we do this? We'll write a sub, and I'm going to pass into this subroutine the schema path where it lives, and also an object called Agrimon Web Service. This object contains various methods implementing the, we might say, the business logic. And we're going to pass this in here so that we can call it from the roots, but having it passed in will also aid us in some testing, and I'll show you that very soon. So then we specify the schema, and I'm just coercing it into an IO object here to make the OpenAPI sub we're calling treat it as a file to read. If we just give it a string, it'll think that that is the schema, which is also an okay way of doing things, but here we want the path. And then we give it a block, and in the block we'll implement our operations. So here we name the operation that we're implementing, which is clone dataset. That refers to the operation ID over in the OpenAPI specification. And then we write a block, and this is where we'll implement the implementation of this operation. Notice how we are not tying ourselves to the URL structure, or that we should do a post to this or something like that. Just like being in a Crow root handler, however, we can still, as our first parameter here, take the current session or user object and constrain it with some type. Here we have a subset type logged in, which is quite a typically done thing when implementing Crow web applications that have authentication requirements. The subset type is then applied against this to check if the user is logged in. Then inside of the implementation of this operation, we'll destructure the request body. Here we're just pulling out those parameters. We're mapping them into slightly more Reku style names. No requirement to do that, but we kind of enjoy the consistency of variable names there. And then we call the business logic, which does the clone of the dataset based upon the things that we submitted. So that's almost done, except we've missed one very important thing, which is that we need to not only deal with the good cases, but also the bad ones. So when there is this exception, we need to map that into a HTTP 409 conflict response, and that is exactly what we are doing here. And that's it. All of the validation of which arguments are required and of the request method, of the types of the things in the body and so forth are handled. So now I have the subroutine API routes, and here we will use this in our top level root block. Notice that this also takes the business logic object and it passes it down, and here we also are including various other routes as well, include being very nice here for composing one top level set of routes out of a bunch of other root blocks. And the open API block actually kind of really is a root block, just with a bit of a different DSL directly inside of it there, but otherwise it produces exactly the same kind of thing, which is why we can include it and just treat it like any other root block. In some cases, we might want to host nothing except the API. We may have no other routes at all. And if that's our situation, then we can actually pass the thing that comes back from the OpenAPI sub directly as the application to host for the Crow HTTP server. We should also test these things. Whenever I fall into the trap of thinking that that this thing is too simple to possibly do wrong, I don't need to test it, then I end up having broken code. So I'm definitely very keen on the testing side of things, and sleep a lot easier knowing that the things that I'm shipping off into production are generally pretty well covered with tests. Crow HTTP test is a module that makes it easier to test basically anything that we have implemented using the Crow root blocks, but really you can use it against any HTTP URL as well. So even if you haven't implemented your application using Crow, you in principle could use this to write the tests for it too. So these are the tools that I reach for most immediately when I want to test my routes. I grab the test module, which has all the basic stuff in, like plan and subtest, that ships with the Rokudo compiler. We then have the Crow HTTP test module, which is the main thing I want to talk about, and then we use test mock. And test mock is a way of making fakes based upon a particular object. So, for example, I want to take this Agramon web session user type. And I don't want to reuse a real session user instance. I just want to have a fake one here. And it will always return this ID when I call the ID method. And when I call the logged in method, it'll always return true. So that just gets me a nice faked up version of this object. If you don't have any authorization going on in your application, then you don't necessarily need to do a fake auth. But I have that for my situation here. Then we can do the same with the business logic object. This is just making sure that we get something the correct type, but it doesn't actually implement any of the behaviors there. We can, if we want, do things like faking return values, computing them based on the input values, or throw exceptions if we want, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to do that here today. Instead, just gets me an object which does nothing upon all of the method calls and just logs that they happened, so I can assert against that later in my tests. So let's make the test itself. We will have a subtest just so these get grouped nicely in the output. We will then call test service, and this is where we pass the Crow application that we want to test. And in this case, this is being done by sending along the routes block result, and that call has had passed into it our fake service. So that will nicely construct the routes with that business logic fake that we can use to check that they do the right thing against it. We send in the fake auth as well, and then we're ready to write the test cases. I'm just going to write one because time is of the essence. So there's a routine called test given, and test given is a way that we can set up some things that will apply to all of the various tests within it. In this case, I don't strictly need it, but I wanted to show you it. So if you are doing many tests of one endpoint or some common headers or something like that, this is very convenient to use. And then here is the test. So we do a test, and we're testing a post with this JSON. So it's relatively comfortable, convenient to write this out. And then we expect that the status of this will be 204. And indeed, if it is, then this test will pass. There's a whole bunch of other assertions we could write there. So am I done yet? Well, not quite, because actually I would like to test that the thing I called really did call the correct business logic method, and it really did pass the correct parameters to it. And I can do this here with calling check mock. There's the fake service. This is our mock object. And then I just pass it the things to check against. And I say, well, did we call the clone dataset method one time? And did we call it with these arguments here? And that backslash thing is a capture literal. It's a way of writing an argument list, but divorced from a particular subroutine call. And that's our test. That's how we can test that clone dataset route does the right kind of thing. So that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and I hope you have learned some things about Crow that you did not previously know.